Thank you, Lynn. This is Richard Leahy, the author of Beyond Jefferson's Vines, The Evolution of Quality Wine in Virginia. And the new second edition of this book, which is 300 pages, is on Amazon.com. You can also find more information on my website, which is Richard Leahy, that's LEAHY.com. And there's a link on the right to more information on the book.
Welcome to Wine and Dine. My name is Lynn Creelo Chamberlain, host. You're listening to iWine Radio.
Joining us this week on iWine Radio is Richard Leahy, who is a wine author, and he is also a wine industry consultant specializing in regional wines east of the Rockies. He's very well published, and his biographical sketch is online at richardleahy.com. But today we're celebrating the release of the second edition of Beyond Jefferson's Vines. And there's so much going on in Virginia, so much so that on Bloomberg Business just a couple months ago, Alan McCoy named Virginia as one of the world's next Big Eight wine regions. And I bet you, Richard, when you saw that, you were just tickled pink because, I mean, you've known for, what, the last 30 years that Virginia was on top of the world.
Well, it's been up and coming, and some wines are better than others, as everywhere else, but people have been following the scene, like Dave McIntyre. He gave a keynote address at the Monticello Wine Cup award ceremony, in which he said that people who have been following the scene, like him and myself for years, have known that there are some great Virginia wines, and so people who say, hey, I've discovered Virginia, haven't, you know, kind of late to the party. However, when someone like Ellen McCoy or Stephen Spurrier say, you know, Virginia is large, then that's big news.
Yes.
And so she named Virginia, and there are eight regions, and they were in the Old World and the New World. Virginia was only two that she named in the United States, yeah. and the rest were Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, the South of England, Georgia, you know, in the former Soviet Republic. So of all those possible regions that she could have, you know, chosen, it really speaks to how Virginia has developed, how the quality has evolved, and how everyone is now really listening to this. For example, Stephen Spurrier, a couple years ago at the Virginia Wine Summit, said flatly that Virginia is his favorite North American wine region because it makes the kinds of wines he likes to drink, which meaning, you know, moderate in alcohol, bright in acidity, and food friendly.
There you go. There you go. Oh, I like that. That's such a wonderful summary. But that being said, Richard, there's still tremendous diversity in different microclimates going from east to west.
Yes, and the book covers the scene in a variety of ways, and I think of, over half of the book is a travelogue and divides the state into the regions that the Virginia Wine Marketing Office has, where you start in the east with the Eastern Shore, and then there's the Tidewater region, and then Northern Virginia, Central Virginia, South Side, and the Southwest. So I visit each of these regions, and through the book, I take you to the wineries of note in each of those regions and have tasting notes, interviews with the producers, mention of major awards, and this new edition has actually grown to 300 pages, so there's a lot of new entries, especially in Northern Virginia and Central Virginia, compared to the first edition of 3 years ago.
You say that there have been 40 new wineries since you first published the book in 2012.
That's right, and one of the examples of the rate of change in the Virginia wine industry is that the largest winery, as in terms of regulation, is being classified as a winery in the state right now is Bold Rock Cidery in Nelson County, and they make 9,000 12-ounce bottles a day.
Wow.
And yeah, and they weren't even operating 3 years ago.
Oh my gosh!
I know. So I put a new chapter in the second edition on the expansion of craft beverages in Virginia, and the cider is the, you know, the foremost player. The rate of growth of cideries is even more so than that of the wineries.
Why do you think? Because people are looking for lower alcohol? I mean, what's the deal?
That's a good question. I think it's part, there's a lot of answers. I think part of it is it's the revival of a craft beverage.
Okay.
And Albemarle Cider Works, actually the first Virginia Cidery was Foggy Ridge Cidery, and they're in the Southwest. And Diane Flipp, the owner, wanted to do this because she wanted to revive heirloom apple varieties that were made for cider. You know,
yeah.
Jefferson said that cider was his everyday beverage. And it was the Virginia cider makers that pressured Congress to have a home winemaking exemption in the Volstead Act. It wasn't the, you know, Northeastern Italians. It was the Virginia cider people. They wanted to be able to keep making hard cider for home consumption. And we lost that heritage after World War II with, you know, the advent of huge breweries and standardization. The low-alcohol sparkling cider disappeared as a mainstay, as a consumer thing. So
yeah.
Diane and other people, like Admiral Cider Company, were looking back to the English hard cider tradition as a colonial beverage, but also, you know, down through the ages until before World War II, especially here in Virginia, Central Virginia, where the apples grow very well. But it wasn't even just here. If you look throughout the original 13 colonies that, you know, were apple-producing states, there were varieties like the Black Twig, Arkansas Black, Grimes, that were cultivated from the peel and the tannin. And now those are in big demand as cideries are moving to make the kind of wine that's closer in style to what the English drink, which is not sweet, bubbly apple juice that's been, you know, fermented, sweetened afterwards, but
right.
is crisp and dry and, like you say, low alcohol and refreshing. I think that part of it also is that millennials are driving growth in wine and consumption in this country, and I think that they think that cider is a pretty cool thing. And their parents weren't into cider. It wasn't really there as a big category.
Yeah.
And so it's also, you know, it's a drink you can have a bottle of for lunch and then not have to worry about not driving or something.
Diane Flint's driest, I don't remember what it's called, her very driest.
I think it's called First Fruit.
It is too. I had an epiphany. It impressed me so seriously. It blew me away. It was so delicious. And it occurred to me that it would appeal to a lot of beer drinkers also.
Well, you're right. And Bull Rock, I went there with the Circle Wide Riders in November, and their co-owner said that they had done a lot of research, and they wanted to have a style that would appeal to beer drinkers. And it's a centrist beverage. It's a non-gender-oriented beverage, and it crosses the barrier between beer and wine pretty easily.
Makes sense. Wow. I don't remember the name of the winery that, gosh, I did a couple of interviews with them years ago, but the one that Donald Trump purchased.
Oh, yes. That was formerly Kluge Estate.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And now...
Still sparkling wines, right?
Well, that's what they're known for. That's their reputation. But they do make most of the volume is actually table wine, still wine. But it gets overshadowed by the sparkling, and for good reason, because the sparkling, the regular vintage is on tirage for 3 years, and then their reserve, which won the Montecillo Cup, is on tirage for 5 years. So they're using the same amount of time on tirage that the major champagne houses do. So as a result, the wines vary, you know, classic in style. But they make very good table wines as well.
What is the name of the winery now?
Well, let's see. If Trump owns it, it would be called Trump. That's it, Trump Winery.
There you go. But as I recall, when I did some looking into it a year or two ago, it's the son that's actually overseeing the winery now.
Yeah, that's a good point, Lynn. I'm glad you mentioned that. It's Eric Trump. The whole thing is his project. His father is not involved at all. So, you know, if people have an issue with the Donald, then, you know, he's not connected to this.
Yeah.
Made an appearance initially, but his son Eric is running it. They live there. He and his wife live there now, and they're really enthusiastic to be contributing to the Virginia wine scene through these quality wines.
So Virginia does have, at least to my knowledge, a couple of standout, stellar, sparkling wine producers. But what would you tell people who have never tasted Virginia wines before? What is Virginia best known for at this stage of the game in 2015?
I think most people, as the state branded itself on the Viognier grape, so that's the one that has, even with the sommeliers, you say, what grape is Virginia branded with, they would say Viognier. It's a very difficult grape to grow, a low yielder, but it ripens reliably here in Virginia. But in California or hotter climates, you lose the delicate fresh fruit when you pass that ripening point. So it makes the most elegantly balanced wines here in Virginia that have even, you know, impressed people. Steven Spurrier, for example, at the London International Wine Fair, was telling people to go to the Virginia booth and try the Viognier because that's the new benchmark. So on the red side, for a single varietal, it's been Cabernet Franc for decades. That grape metabolizes well in clay soils, as well as Merlot. So those two grapes are strong here in Virginia, just as they are in Southern Mayenne, for the same reason, because clay soils dominate. However, the people watching the higher-end reds now, really the red Bordeaux blends, the Meritage-style blends, that's the hot thing right now. And most of them will be what you call a right bank style, where you have Cabernet Franc and Merlot are the dominant grapes. Okay. But increasingly, we're seeing Petit Verdot and even Tannat now coming into the blends. And those two make those two could really be the game changers for Virginia reds in the future.
What are the laws in Virginia, Richard? Are people allowed to go to the websites, and if they can't get on the road, and, you know, buy a copy of the second edition of Beyond Jefferson's Vines and study it, and go to the websites, order wine? Do they ship outside of Virginia?
Good question, Lynn. And the answer is yes, but it's a reciprocal situation.
Okay.
So roughly 30 states now allow direct shipping to consumers over 21 from one way, you know, from the winery to the consumer. Of course, there has to be an adult to sign for it. So people need to check with FedEx or UPS and then, you know, look and see which states that they're authorized to ship wine to.
Okay.
So those who live in reciprocal states can receive wine from Virginia. I'm pretty sure Florida, Massachusetts cannot. I'm pretty sure North Carolina is reciprocal. I would recommend not doing it once, you know, we get into like a month from now in mid-June. I'd recommend not ordering wines during the summer because it just gets too hot. And the wineries, you know, will pack it. But if it sits in a truck too long, you know, I recommend, you know, any time between October and through the end of May is when people can safely order wines and not have them worried about being too hot. Of course, if you live in Minnesota, it might be a different story. But, yeah, and talking about ordering the book, it's on Amazon, and it's 300 pages for less than $14, and I don't think there's a better deal for a wine book out there. But people have to look for the second edition because there's a reseller doing remnants of the first edition. So it's got a red triangle in the upper right corner, and that's the one that's the new second edition.
You've got to come back and remind people, you know, at the end of the year so they could use this also as a stocking stuffer, especially for people who are, you know, grew up in Virginia and no longer live in Virginia and miss Virginia. This would be such a nice reminder of home.
Yes, and if they have friends and relatives in the same boat who, you know, had been in Virginia before or who are wine-oriented and just have no idea about the fact that we have a 400-year history of wine in Virginia, wine growing in Virginia, and, of course, also for Father's Day, that's what's coming up. And there are chapters on history, on viticulture, that explain how difficult it is to grow wine grapes here because they're not immune to fungal diseases the way our native plants are, and that's been the big problem. But we also have phylloxera, we have the great root borer, the great fairy moth, not to mention all of the birds and mammals that want to get a piece of the action with chomping on grapes. Everything from microbes to bears wants a grape, you know, including us humans. So we have to compete with a lot out there in the realms of nature, and that's a big reason why Jefferson wasn't able to get his crop.
Wow, he would just be amazigated at what's going on in Virginia now.
Yes, I mean, if you look at, there are two wineries in particular I start off the book with, just to show how diverse Virginia winery visiting is now. One is RDV, which I'm sure you've heard of. Jancis Robinson has highly praised them, and they're charging $90 a bottle for their Left Banks Cabernet Sauvignon-based 2010 blend. and I think maybe 55 for the Right Bank blend. And anyone who does that attracts attention, but in that case, you know, it's not just smoke and mirrors, it's the real deal. And Barbersville, of course, has been working patiently for decades to build a reputation for their brand, and they've also been a great ambassador for Virginia wine. And now the Octagon has, you know, up until recently with the RDV Lost Mountain, they call it, their Octagon has been the preeminent Virginia red blend for decades. Jim Law, of course, is his hard scrabble, his estate red, is also highly sought after. So it's good that people are getting the word, you know, about Virginia and Virginia wine. In fact, one of the folks who recently entered the industry was Steve and Gene Case. They bought a winery in Madison County, and it's now called Early Mountain. And they have, you know, they're from the AOL fortune. They started AOL. But they lived in Fairfax County, which, you know, was the home of AOL and the Internet. But they wanted to give back to the state, so they decided to buy a winery and use their resources. And so one of the things they do is if you go to Ernie Mountain, they have a curated tasting of wines from around the state. So they save you the trouble of having to physically go all over the state. They'll actually take you through the east, the north, the south, the west, and have it all there.
Wow. Yeah. That's very, very generous of them.
Indeed. And the other winery I mentioned in that first chapter is Pippin Hill. And you can't get into RDV very easily. You have to make an appointment and then pay $40 to taste just a couple of wines. But if you go to Pippin Hill, they have stunning views. They have a restaurant. Most of their business is high-end weddings because it's a husband and wife team, and she had a New York, you know, high-end wedding business. But they grow grapes, and they make wine, and they have a winery. But, you know, it's kind of the opposite model of RDV, but it's still a wonderful place to visit with fantastic views, and you feel like you're in Virginia wine country.
And you also have in the second edition of Beyond Jefferson's Vines a vintage chart and a grape glossary, because in Virginia they're not just growing vinifera. People have, what, hybrids? And
that's right. They have we have some of the old generation French hybrids, like Sauvignon and Vidal for white, and then Chamberson for red. But now we also have the new Geneva hybrids, such as Traminette out of Geneva, New York, which is from Cornell University. And that's half of one parent is Gewurztraminer, and the other parent is a white French hybrid. And it makes a beautifully aromatic wine, but it's much more sustainable to grow than Gewurztraminer.
Okay.
And then we also have grapes like Petit Monsang. This is a vinifera grape from the southwest of France. It's kind of obscure, but it's got thick skins. It's very fruity, and it's got high acid. So it's a very good combination for the Virginia climate.
Makes sense. That thick skin can withstand attacks from fungus.
Exactly. And we also are with Tanat, which a lot of people may not have heard of. That's a very promising grape for Virginia, and also is a great blender with Petit Verdot, which is another, a lot of people think that's going to be the up-and-coming grape for us.
Wow.
And then I make wine at home, and with 2013, I did bench trials, and I ended up with four different blends of Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, and Tanat. And the one I like the best is 25% each of Cab Franc and Merlot, so that's half the blend, 30% Petit Verdot, and then 20% Tanat. And that makes an amazing wine. It takes it out of the Red Bordeaux flavor range, but if you did straight Petit Verdot and Tanat, that's a very coarse kind of wine. You'd have to lay it down for a few years before you could really enjoy it.
Richard, do you give this to friends as Christmas presents and such, or do you actually
have it? I do.
Okay. You don't have it up for sale, do you?
No, that's a whole other layer of regulation and complexity I have no desire to get into. It allows me, you know, a lot of freedom. And I just bought my first wine filter, which I can carry in the palm of my hand. It's about the size of a football, but it works, and it does 5 gallons at a time. And I can get my wines clean and not worry about, you know, stray yeast cells and that kind of thing. But it's a lot of fun, but I have 10 vines at my townhouse. It's like, you know, I've maxed out my plantable acreage at 10 vines. But they're in their first year of full production this year, and they're all, Traminette are starting to flower now, so I'm looking forward to a nice harvest come fall.
And was this like a painting party, but it was a harvest party? Did you have friends come over and help you pick the grapes, or did you do that all by yourself?
Well, no, I've done it by myself, and I may get some friends just because there'll be a lot of clusters this time, but they'll probably come in at different times, so I'll probably just do it myself.
Okay.
Yeah, and I use a salad spinner as my press for the whites. So I'll de-stem them, and then I'll put them in the salad spinner and just crank it up to separate the juice from the skins, because that's how small of a scale I work on. And I took a lawn cedar, you know, with the spike in the middle, and that's what I used for my crusher stemmer.
Oh, you're ingenious.
Yeah, I turn to one of the wheels, you know, with a crank, and that's how I get the thing to work. it's all about operating to scale.
Oh my gosh! And people can actually see pictures of one of your vines online at richardleahy.com, where they can also subscribe to your wine report.
Yeah, Richard Leahy's wine report.
Yep, cool.
And on the report right now, I have a press release from the Virginia Wine Marketing Office with a picture of me and Secretary Todd Hamel, the Secretary of Agriculture, as I'm presenting him with a signed copy of the second edition.
Oh, wow. That's so cool. So, again, for when people want to purchase the second edition of Beyond Jefferson's Vines, they go to Amazon.com, and they're looking for the little triangle.
Yeah, a red triangle in the upper right corner. And it's like 13, it's somewhere less than $14, but it's got a bright cover, brighter than the first one, and it's in paperback, and it's got that red triangle in the upper right. And the size is 6 by 9 inches, so it's really convenient if you're on the road.
Yeah.
I also have driving directions between wineries.
Oh,
and, I know that people can get that off and on a website, but what if you're driving in wine country, you can't get cell phone service?
Okay.
So it makes it very useful.
Okay. Oh, you've got everything, all the bases covered. Well, Richard Leahy, it's been such a joy to touch base with you again, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to shout out your second edition of Beyond Jefferson's Vines and this fantastic news about Virginia. And what a wonderful destination idea for a vacation. But if people are not vacationing just for visiting wineries, if you've seen friends and relatives, why not visit a winery or two?
Absolutely. We have wineries, you know, now that are close to the Hampton Roads area. Of course, Williamsburg Winery is right there, but there are others. And then the Northern Neck is a nice vacation land close to D.C. You've got a whole mess of wineries in Loudoun and Fauquier counties. And then here in central Virginia, and even in the Roanoke area and Stanton. So anywhere in the state, you can find a winery within an hour's drive.
You know the whole state like the back of your hand.
Well, I had to do a lot of research to get the book together.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate the opportunity. Great talking to you.
You're listening to iWine Radio, first in Wine Talk. I'm Lynn Creelo-Chamberlain.